You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
3 years ago, high food prices threatened the livelihoods of billions of people worldwide who are already struggling to get enough to eat each day. All over the world, governments and organizations took action to cope with the crisis triggered by skyrocketing food prices. A new report by the UK Hunger Alliance and the Oakland Institute investigates whether these responses were appropriate and effective. The report also looks at whether high food prices have brought about any changes in food and agricultural policies. Frederick Musso wrote the report. He's a senior fellow at the Oakland Institute and a food security consultant who works with international relief and development agencies. And he joins me by phone this morning from Oakland, California. Good morning, Frederick.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. What made food prices go up so dramatically in 2007 and 2008?
Well, that time there was a combination of factors. We've seen the support to biofuels in a number of countries, which really boosted the price of corn. We've seen poor harvest in some countries. We've seen speculation. So there was a range of different factors. What our report really looked at is what were the responses to the food crisis rather than the causes themselves.
Now, some countries managed to protect their populations from the impact of these skyrocketing prices. How did they do that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting finding of the report, because everybody had in mind that the global food prices went up all over the world. And we've seen the international price of rice, for instance, going up 200% in the early months of 2008. But actually, when you go country by country, you find out that Indonesia, for instance, had a decrease in prices, or a very low decrease in prices, when some neighboring countries had increases by 100% or more. So there was no systematic transmission of the prices from the global markets to the domestic ones. And this is clearly explained by the capacity of countries to somehow regulate their food and agriculture markets, managing the domestic availability of food through a management of imports and exports, through fiscal policies, through the use of stocks, so all this kind of public mechanisms that have been in place in a number of countries. And what we have seen also, that those who didn't have these mechanisms saw the highest rates of increase on their markets. And we can see that in a number of African countries which have withdrawn their public intervention on food markets.
Now, you say in your report that the bulk of the response to the rise in domestic prices was borne by the people themselves. How did they cope with that?
Yeah, that's another interesting finding. We all have in mind that, especially with what we see in media, with big G8 meetings and food conference all over in the north, with all these northern leaders saying they're going to tackle the food crisis. And then when you compare it, you see that the rich countries have spent $100 billion in all international assistance in 2008. At the same time, remittances, money going from migrants to their families, were more than three times more, $340 billion in 2008. And it was really an increase due to high food prices in 2008, as we've seen a 40% increase in 2008. It means that families and people have been actually much more responsive than governments and all the rich countries and leaders we've seen in front of cameras and in big conferences.
So these would be family members living outside the country who would have sent remittances or money to support their relatives or friends inside the country.
Yeah, this is when we talk about remittances. It's recorded remittances, so it's not all the money that is being sent. So we can think it's much more, but it's all the remittances sent from abroad. So it's all from migrants, and we can see there the immigration debate is so close to the development one, and usually we see them separated. And we should realize that whatever we do on immigration in northern countries has a big impact on the level on the livelihood, on the level of hunger and poverty in the South, because this is really about money sent from abroad, from migrants who are struggling to work, to feed their families in their home country.
So in fact, sort of the biggest global aid program during that time to deal with the crisis was coming from family members who were migrants.
Yeah, it was not organized. It was it's just simply people who get a letter or a call saying we're having a hard time at home because, yes, in poor countries, the increase in food prices was a very terrible pressure on livelihoods because the poor people all over the world spend most of their income on food. And it was, of course, when you have a 200% increase of your staple food, you are really struggling to feed your family. And we've seen certainly all over the world this demands for help for migrants, but also more migration. Apparently, a number of countries, when times are harsh, see especially the men, the veteran men, leaving the place to find job in another place. We see that a lot. I was recently in Niger. Many rural areas in Niger see most of their valid men leave for 6 to 8 months a year to seek jobs, employment in neighboring countries because they just can't make it at home.
Now, you talk about the role of the World Food Program. What is that program, first of all?
The World Food Program is the international UN organization in charge of international food aid. And for a long time, the international food aid has been in-kind food aid coming mainly from U.S., Canada, Europe, sent to developing countries to feed their populations, let's say. And we, at the Auckland Institute, we've been critical of the way programs have been going for many years because in-kind food aid coming from northern producers going into southern markets have actually the potential to undermine severely the food production and the markets locally because it creates some dumping and it creates some unfair competition with local production. What was interesting this time was that after many years of us and other NGOs criticizing this in-kind food aid being forwarded to developing countries, what we have seen in 2007, 2008 is a very impressive increase in local purchases of food aid. Donors giving money instead of in-kind food so that the World Food Program can buy food locally in Africa and Asia. And this is very important because if you buy food locally, you buy food from farmers and you help them doing business. And by doing business, you help them getting out of poverty at the end of the day. And this is really an important link we can do between immediate relief and long-term development. And so we've been really appreciative of this trend and of the efforts of the World Food Program to do that. One little reservation we still have on that is that so far the local purchases have been mainly happening with large-scale farmers, with sometimes big plantations and richer farmers in the South. Now the challenge is to procure food aid from small farmers who are those in poverty. We don't need to feed big corporates who have big businesses in Uganda or South Africa. We need really to help the poor, who are the poor farmers, smallholders, who have small plots of land, and this is the next challenge for the World Food Program.
So in the short term, productions levels were raised and there was procurement at a local level. Do you think that the structural issues or the long term way that food production and local food security was addressed through this crisis, or we still have those challenges?
No, unfortunately, I have to say that the situation may be worse today because a lot of the focus has been about food production. A lot of thinking has been, okay, we have a production crisis. And it was not a production crisis. We had a number of factors, but we had playing for the price increase. But we had in 2008, 2009, record world production of food. we had more food produce in the world than ever before, and still we had these high fluctuations. We can have a lot of production, and then if the food goes all into energy for cars, it doesn't really solve the problem of hunger. So that's just an example, because there are different factors like speculation and others. Also, what's really concerning us at the moment is that seeing high food prices, a number of actors, countries, food importing countries, but also investors, financial actors, have seen food as an interesting commodity to invest in. And land also as an interesting new product for financial markets. So what we've seen in the past few years is, instead of really boosting food production for the poor and the hungry, we've seen a lot of investment from rich countries, from international companies and corporates, investing in the food as a commercial commodity to put it on the market. So you have now what we call the land grab happening in many countries in Africa, for instance, where you would have a foreign company buying land in the country to produce food that will be exported from the country. And the country can still, like Ethiopia, receive hundreds of tons of food aid every year. They will have some of their land taken away to feed some of their consumers elsewhere. So that's a very concerning trend for us.
What do you think is the biggest lesson that we can learn from the food crisis?
I think that's an important one, that we are not facing a problem of production. And it's still, when we're talking about hunger, we still have a lot of that in mind. And I've just said around land grab is a concerning trend. At the same time, the positive trend and the good lesson that we have seen learned by many policymakers, political leaders, especially in Africa and Asia, is that we can't just rely on the market for food supply. And what we've been told for many years about, we need to open our borders and to open our economy and we'd have cheap food and it will work well for everybody, we see as limits. A country like Senegal was importing 50% of its food needs. When suddenly prices skyrocket, as they do in 2008, realize that they don't have a secure food supply, and that this dependency on the global market they are now in is seriously problematic and makes them in a very vulnerable position. So this, the lesson for Senegal president, for instance, as for many other leaders, is, maybe we should not be as dependent for our food supply. Our food sovereignty is important. We need to be sure to secure our food supply like we need to secure our water and our energy supply, because it's vital for economy, for political stability, and so on. And this might mark a kind of revival of food and agricultural policies in the developing world, because it was a bit abandoned to the trade and to the market for many years. Let's aim for economic growth and let's just rely on the market. Now we might have a kind of return of policy, a return of regulation, which might, at the end of the day, save the interest of the poor in these countries. And we're really looking forward to seeing these changes happen.
Well, it's been very interesting speaking with you this morning, Frederick. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
I've been speaking with Frederick Mousseau. He's the author of The High Food Price Challenge, A Review of Responses to Combat Hunger. And this report is a joint publication of the UK Hunger Alliance and the Oakland Institute. You can find it at oaklandinstitute.org. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.